Hey everyone, it's Andrew Warner, founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart, and you're about to watch one of my best interviews. This is with Eric Ries, who's been writing about a concept called lean startups. This is gold for startups. You're going to hear ideas about how to keep your startup running lean so that you can listen to your customers and keep iterating with them. And I've got a great example here from Eric of how he did that at his company, InView. He is currently also, in addition to writing about lean startups in addition to being the co-founder of InView, I'm looking at my notes obviously here, he's also the venture advisor at Kleiner Perkins. All right, here's my interview with Eric Ries. What is IMVU?
So InView is a company we started in 2004. There were five of us co-founders at the time. And we had come off the heels of a previously totally failed startup and wanted to try and do things a little bit differently. So it was really the first time we got to put a lot of the lean startup concepts into practice around building a product iteratively, about really co-creating the product with our customers rather than telling them what to do. And to answer your question literally, it was a 3D avatar, instant messaging and social networking site. So it started out life kind of as a instant messaging add-on that would add 3D chat capabilities to existing IM clients, and since then it's evolved into a full social network where instead of using your real identity as the hook for all of your networking, friend requests, gifts, all that stuff, it's a virtual identity based around a 3D avatar. The content is all created by third parties, so it's all user-generated content. If you're a budding aspirational clothing designer and just haven't told anybody yet, you can go on InView, download the tools for free, and you can actually make money by selling your own clothing line.
All right, well, let's go back a little bit then. You talked about your failed startup that led to your changed thinking. Can you talk about that a little bit more? What was the startup and what went wrong?
Well, I try not to name names when I'm talking about failure, but I had come out to Silicon Valley in 2001 to join another virtual worlds company that really built using the traditional Silicon Valley kind of linear plan game. So raise a lot of money, build a really world-class team, hire the best and the brightest, build a kind of a technology platform that would be a real engineering contribution to the world, you know, patent pending the works. And we built it in stealth R&D. So we spent years and tens of millions of dollars building this platform, which was really, from a technology point of view, really impressive. And I was on a technology team, so it was kind of like engineer's playground. You know, we had a good time. It was really a satisfying thing to work on. And the only problem was when we finally came down to launch the product and we had a great launch, we were in Wall Street Journal and New York Times and the whole shebang, not enough customers showed up to buy the product to sustain the massive burn rate we had built the company up to. So I got kind of a front row seat at that calamity. And it was both really painful to see because, of course, the energy of all those incredibly creative and smart people kind of went to waste and the company became a defense contractor and, you know, wasn't a great outcome. But it was, as they say in the Valley, a great learning experience.
Isn't the Valley great? In fact, isn't technology great in general? Because it does forgive so much as long as you learn something from the experience.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, I saw a study recently that showed that founders who had been in a previously failed startup were actually no more likely to be successful than founders who hadn't. That is, failure itself is not actually a predictor of future success. So we got to figure out some way to measure what people have learned from the experience. I really think that's what counts.
Let's talk a little bit more about that first company. You said that you spent a long time in stealth mode. What is it about stealth mode that still keeps people, that still draws smart people to it? I mean, we've seen companies that have gone through stealth mode for a long time and then come out with products that markets weren't excited about. I've done so many interviews here with people who've heard those stories before, and they still go into stealth mode for 18. I think Ari Mir told me his previous company, the founder of Gum Gum, told me in his previous company he spent 18 months in stealth mode just building the ideal product and it didn't work. And he's a smart guy who's heard other people. What is it about it that captivates people so much?
Well, you know, it's actually a perfectly rational strategy. I mean, it has a certain internal logic to it, and all the so-called best practices that are actually lethal, the reason they're lethal is that they actually make sense if you don't look at the right, you don't look at them in the right way. So I mean, I get to meet now with a lot of entrepreneurs, both as an advisor and in my consulting practice. And I was just talking to an entrepreneur recently who just he couldn't accept that the risk of people stealing his idea, or kind of prematurely judging it a failure, were greater than the risk that he was building something that nobody wanted. Because his point of view was he's building something radically new. He's a real innovator, very smart guy. Customers don't know what they want. So even if he goes out and does a bunch of focus groups and asks customers, hey, do you want this crazy new thing? They're probably going to say no, but that's not very indicative. So to hit from his point of view, the risk is he's going to tell the world about his thing. People are going to steal his idea. You know, those people who get it will steal his idea, and then he'll miss the window on the opportunity. And those people who don't get it are just going to heap humiliation and scorn on him for no reason. So when you look at it from that point of view, I think it's actually a perfectly rational response to those fears. You know, who wants to be humiliated and have their good ideas stolen? And I think the only problem with that is that, I mean, I think it really misunderstands the risks of pursuing it.
So, what are the risks involved there? The risks are that you get out of touch with your customer, right?
Yeah.
What else?
Well, I think, I mean, we say like, well, you know, so you'll get out of touch. I actually think the question, the way I would think about it is, did you ever get in touch with your customers in the first place? I mean, stealth is is kind of a customer-free zone where you get to operate without external feedback. So all the things that external feedback might do for you are absent, and that's both the good and the bad things, right? External feedback might cause you to abandon a great idea prematurely. But also, it can help you realize that the vision that you're currently pursuing is actually a delusion. So, you know, I've said this a couple times now. Great startup founders create around them what I call the reality distortion field. That is the ability to convince other people that this thing that they believe in is real, even though, of course, it isn't. And that's true of great founders and really terrible ones. That is, it's a necessary attribute. People need to believe in what they're working on in order for the employees and the shareholders, everybody in the company to have the intensity, the creativity, the passion for the product. And just the slight risk is that also, you know, sociopaths and other crazy people have that same power to convince people to believe in all kinds of stuff that has no basis in reality. So I think the basic concept is that if you're in stealth mode, you get positive reinforcement from your sense of satisfaction for building the product, but you don't get any actual feedback. And so you can go wildly off course even if your initial concept was only a few degrees off. So you think of it like a moonshot. You know, if you launch the rocket, you know, early on it's pretty cheap to course correct 1 or 2 degrees, but after you've gone a fair distance, those errors magnify.
You know, Eric, when you talk to me about the entrepreneur who's afraid that that the smart people would steal his idea and the dumb people would ridicule it, I was thinking of
Yeah.
Hulu.com. Hulu, before they launched, they didn't even have a name. Michael Arrington of TechCrunch called them the Clown Network, I think.
Yeah.
Everyone in the business said, there's no reason for Fox and NBC to create another video site with YouTube, Blip, and a million others out there, and they're going to get it wrong. And what did Hulu do? They built this thing largely in quiet. They didn't release it in stages. They didn't come out with a smaller version and a bigger version. They didn't do a lot of
Yeah.
the things that we're going to be talking about with lean startups. So maybe there's some rationality to that.
Well, look, when I mean, the market only rewards you for being right. It doesn't actually reward superior process per se. So I mean, I don't know anything about the Hulu situation, so I can't comment on that story specifically. My guess is actually they had more customer contact than people give them credit for. I actually think it's a lot of those other pure technology video sites that, just gauging from what the product is, they look to me like engineers building a solution in search of a problem. That is, they're not actually really designed to give customers what they want. And as far as I can tell, Hulu really is. Hulu is a very clear, simple value proposition to watch TV online. People want to watch TV, they want to watch it online. Hulu is basically the only site that delivers on that very simple value proposition. So there's clearly some customer insight embedded in that product, where it came from. You know, did it come from just pure visionaries working in secret, you know, just pulling those ideas out of their head? You know, that's of course possible, but I find that a little bit hard to believe.
So you're saying there was probably customer experience there, but it wasn't Michael Arrington who was the customer, and it wasn't Andrew, and it wasn't Eric who were there. It was probably real users who are going to have this in their homes.
That's what I hope. And in fact, so people sometimes get confused because I'm a big opponent of stealth mode generally, but I also tell startups not to launch. And some people are like, wait a minute, if the whole point of leaving stealth mode is to have that big launch where everyone says, you know, what a genius you are. And so what I try to get people to do is separate out the concepts of the product launch, that is the showing of the product to customers, and just separate that out from the marketing launch, which is talking to Michael Arrington and all the other PR and press outlets where you want to really deliver a strongly positioned message. And to say, look, launching the product is a good thing. Get customers in the door as early as possible and start using their feedback to inform your vision, not replace your vision, but inform it. And then when you're really ready, when you actually understand what customers want, what the unit economics of your business is, when effectively you can predict the future, that is when you launch, you know exactly what's going to happen because you've got the data to back it up, that's the time to go talk to PR and you know, put out the press release and kind of do all the activities that are we traditionally associate with a launch. Maybe you can even still have a launch party, although I don't necessarily agree with, I don't necessarily recommend that. And I think people don't realize in a lot of cases that marketing launch could be years after the product launch, because it may take you that long to really get the concept.
You know, this might seem a little too small to even talk about, but maybe we just need a different name for this process, because when I started doing interviews with people who told me that they were burned by stealth mode, one of the biggest feedbacks that I got was, Andrew, define stealth mode. Because if stealth mode means that you are only in your office with only your employees building this and interacting with your software, then absolutely it's a problem. But if stealth mode means you are interacting with your product and your consumers, but it's a small audience that maybe you found using Google Ads, or maybe you even found on here on 3rd Street Promenade and you brought them into your office to interact. If stealth mode means quietly testing it with real customers, but a small portion of them, then that's a good thing. So what do we call this?
Absolutely.
What do we call this process where we create the product and we take it out to people before the marketing launch?
I mean, it's really the essence of it is what Steve Blank calls customer development. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the specific name that we use for the set of activities you do to try to validate the market concept before you do the big launch. And Steve breaks it down into a series of phases, customer discovery, customer validation, especially of the phases we're talking about here. I mean, I'll tell you a story from early days at InView. We had a no PR, no press rule, because we wanted to stay focused on customers. We felt like in the previous company, we really gotten burned by being focused on what investors wanted, what journalists would want, or kind of everybody but customers would want. So we were trying to stay focused. But we got a phone call from Wired magazine. They wanted to run an article about how InView was the future of instant messaging. And we thought, boy, that's too good to turn down. You know, we didn't have a lot of other things to show our investors to say that we're doing a good job. And at the time, one of my co-founders and I were actually auditing Steve Blank's class at UC Berkeley at the Haas School of Business. And so the article happened to come out that day. We were going up to the class, and we Steve was an investor in our company, so we wanted to show him progress. We had this pressure to make him feel like we're doing something right. And you know, when you only have a few hundred customers, and we were making a few hundred dollars a month in revenue, I mean, it felt to us like those micro-scale results were pretty insignificant. So we were always looking for ways to show that we're doing a good job so that, you know, our investors would be happy. And good investor management is very important. So we brought the article. We showed it to Steve. And, you know, I don't know if that classroom, the debris is probably still lying around. I don't know if they had to do a remodel. I don't actually really remember much of what happened afterwards. He was so angry with us because he understood in a way that we even then didn't. This is only a few months after we started the company, that what matters is what's your understanding of the business model? That is, even at microscale, customer behavior is relatively predictable. So if you can, you know, even on 1,000 active users, if you can prove that you have a product that makes $1 per customer per month and only costs you 10 cents per customer to acquire, like, do the math. If you can scale a business like that up to 100 million people, you're going to make an awful lot of money. And if it costs you $1.10 to bring in those customers, you only make $1, then you can't make it up in volume. So finding out which of those two worlds you're living in with the kind of product concept that you have, using early adopters to validate it, that is really the essence of creating value in an early stage company. And it was funny, even as we were doing it at InView, it was so easy to get distracted, so easy to get knocked off that game, because there's intense pressure out there in the world to, you know, have something you can show mom to say, No, we really did do a good job, look. And it's a unfortunately very dangerous force.
You know, I was going to edit it out, but when we started the interview, I mispronounced the company name. That's how unaware of it I was. And I'm reading all these magazines. I'm reading every blog that I can
Yeah,
to find out
absolutely.
about
No,
the
it's
industry.
fine.
And that's intentional because you're focused on your audience. You're not focused on me. I'm probably not going to dress up my avatar as much and spend as much money as other people are.
You
Is
know,
that right?
I'll leave that up to you. I don't want to call into question anything you do in private, but that's right. And actually, the name InView is not a very good name for the company. I mean, it's not like we did a lot of market research to really pick the optimal name. We had a policy where we felt like spending time on the name of the company was something that could really suck up a lot of time and energy. So we would just pick a name at the beginning of each week. So we would live with every name for 1 week. And our agreement was, for the whole week, we would refer to the company by that name that we picked. We'd get the domain name. You know, we only choose names that we thought we could get the domain. Anytime we wrote the name of the company, we'd use that name in the source code. You can still find there are these like archaic references to these old names. And at the end of the week, we'd pick a new name for the next week. And we just kept doing that until 1 week we just said, you know what? Let's not have the meeting next week. Let's live with this name for another week. Seems pretty good. And that's how we wound up with InView. We always thought the next week we'd come up with a better name. And you know, and like 6 months, 8 months, a year later, we're still talking about, hey, do you think we should change the name? Yeah, maybe we'll get around to it. You know, we eventually grew to accept it, and customers didn't seem to mind it. So, you know, was it the most like carefully crafted marketing strategy in the world? No, but it worked out okay. And even after we had tens of millions of customers using the product, I think we were a top 1,000 website in the world, and we still had no press attention whatsoever. We got that phone call from Wired Magazine, and after that, you know, until we actually launched the company and started doing PR, you know, nobody stole our idea. Nobody, like, the whole fear was just totally misplaced.
What am I to take away from the story about your name? Is it that InView ended up being a better name that you thought? Is it that the name really doesn't matter that much? Or is it that there are other things that are more important that if you have limited resources at a startup, you should focus on those, even if there's a much better name somewhere out there?
Yeah, it's a little bit of all of those things. I mean, I think that last point is really well taken. There are some companies where the name is really an essential part of the strategy. For example, if you're building a product that solves an acute problem that people are searching for, and there are incumbent players that kind of have good brand recognition around that product, the right branding strategy is to name your company after the SEO term that you want to capture, right? So you know, if people are looking for better email. And you understand them well enough to know that that's what they're searching for, then you want to call your product betteremail.com, because that's going to automatically give you this kind of intrinsic boost against the incumbents who have to have a more general brand, right? Microsoft can't, you know, rename the company. It has to be Microsoft. And similar with all kind of established companies. And there are other situations where, you know, it really does matter that the brand associations that you create for customers are the right ones. It's just, how do you know if you're in one of those situations or not? I think that if InView had turned out to be a lethally bad name, we would have found out really soon, and we wouldn't have been so sanguine about it. If it turned out to matter a great deal in the positive direction, we would have known that too. But in all these cases where it didn't matter too much, it wasn't such a critical decision, there were things that mattered more, we could let our customers kind of tell us that. And again, not by running the world's biggest focus group, but by really understanding how the actions that we took affected their behavior. And then trying to understand why. What does that mean about who they are? What does it mean for the next set of activities that we should try to undertake?
Okay, so then let's talk about InView and how you launched it using better customer research, better customer information. What was the idea originally when you guys were just sitting around and saying that you wanted to launch a new business? What was at the core there?
Yeah. So I can tell the story two ways. And they're both equally true. First way is we were geniuses. We had this really powerful insight at the very beginning that there was a market opportunity for a lightweight, avatar-based self-expression and creativity product that would allow customers to create an alternate identity that they felt kind of truly represented who they were on the inside and project that out to the world. And so therefore, you know, we needed for the self-expression content, we needed to have user-generated content, we needed third-party developers, we needed a great variety of expressiveness in the avatar and a bunch of other stuff like that. And I could say, we had that idea in 2004, and if you look at what InView is today, it's now a, you know, I don't know, 60-person company. It's doing quite well. All those elements are still core to the product. So weren't we just the most brilliant visionaries ever? I can tell the story a second way, which is we had this insight that InView is a 3D instant messaging add-on that in order to capitalize on the network effects inherent in the instant messaging business and avoid the switching costs from network to network, would interoperate with every IM client and would have an inherently viral distribution channel, because every time when I'm having a regular IM with you, we would insert a button into the UI. You could just push one button, boom, now it's a 3D conversation. And of course, as a side effect of that, the other person got an invitation link to join InView right there in the chat stream from a friend. And so it was going to have this viral distribution for people to use the 3D avatar chat with their friends. And every element of that part of the vision was also present from day one, and every aspect of that is wrong. So everything I just said is empirically incorrect. The network effect strategy was a terrible idea. Instant messaging add-on is not the right vehicle. The idea that people were going to use this primarily with their friends was mistaken. The idea that it would have this viral growth was also mistaken. I mean, everything about that was wrong. And so, boy, you could say, God, the founders were idiots. Right? Can you believe we were so stupid we didn't even understand those basic things about what we were creating? And that the problem is that both of those stories are equally true. And if we'd gone back to 2004 and asked us which elements of the vision are essential and which ones, you know, maybe could go by the wayside, we would not have been able to tell you the story I can tell you now that, like, well, the first half is like, that's the really important stuff, and the second half, that's the really stupid stuff. It all seemed essential at the time. That's the problem. What's the vision? What's the delusion? You can't tell until you really start to put those ideas into practice and kind of judge them against reality. And that's, you know, all the processes we use that helped us determine that we were on a really bad path are in that category.
I've got to tell you, I've read your blog, and I read the story of how you thought that an add-on to instant message was the way to go. And I said, even today, knowing that that's wrong, that that's not the way, the direction you chose, it absolutely makes sense to me. What, these guys are going to go and recreate instant messenger? I've got tons of instant messengers. My girlfriend.
Why would you want another one?
Sorry?
Why would you want another one?
Why? Yeah, this is absolutely wrong. And that is not what your customer, and if I were to sit down in a room with you, I would say, let's not build a new one. Let's build an add-on. Let's make sure it's right and then get it out there. And that would be a failed company. We'd end up spending way too much time building an add-on. So
to this day, I meet with investors who tell me that that's their idea for how they could improve InView. We should really make it interoperate with the other IM clients. So they don't understand why we don't do that.
So how did you know that that was not the right way, to build onto somebody else's instant messenger was not the right way? And how much did you have to wrestle with yourself, honestly, to accept that data?
I was the last person in the world who wanted to accept this outcome, and I'll tell you why in a second. But let me answer your question directly in two ways. The first is, we were really disciplined about setting overall company metrics in terms of results from day one. So we had a sales plan for that very first product. The instant messaging add-on, from the day we put it out in open public beta, we were charging money for that product. And we were like, look, the first month, I think we were going to make $300. And the next month, it had to be $350, and then $500. I mean, we had sales targets that we had to make. And so part of the first critical element in us discovering we had the wrong product was noticing that it became very difficult to make those sales targets. Right? At least we were able to sell to our friends and some family. And I mean, we ran out of friends awfully fast. And it was that desperation to, like, no, we got to figure out a way to make these sales that took us on to Google AdWords, where we discovered, you know, I've written on the blog about the $5 a day AdWords campaign. I was the first VP of marketing. I mean, I did my best to try to bring customers in. And just, you know, at the end, day after day, when 0% of customers are buying, you know, it really motivates you to try to figure out what's wrong. So the first step is to get the motivation to really test against reality, which is where most companies fail right there. Is they're not really that interested, frankly, in whether people like their product or not. It's more fun to believe. I've been there, right? But so once we were motivated to find out, then that really said, all right, we started to instrument the product to understand, where are we losing people? So, you know, are people downloading but they're not chatting? Are they chatting but they're not buying? You know, where's the problem? So we got good at learning to see the analytics for that. And then when we would try to run experiments where we'd make changes to the features, we would expect those features would improve the percentage customers who would do the thing that we download, then And then what we noticed was the feature changes we were making weren't making any difference. So we're making the product better every day, yet the numbers are staying the same. So now we're really motivated, right? Because now we understand that we have a macro level problem, and we understand that our ability to affect that problem through product development is not working either. And that got us to the point of desperation that we were actually willing to start talking to some customers. And we would bring customers into our office, and we would, I'll tell you exactly how it would go. We'd sit a customer down and we'd say, try this new product, it's InView. They'd be like, okay, that's cool. And if they were kind of a teenager or kind of a heavy user of IM, someone who was like a tech early adopter, like they'd engage with us. And if they were, you know, basically a mainstream person, they would look at us like, whoa, what do you want me to do? And they, like, we could basically get nowhere. So it's like, okay, obviously we need to be talking to people who understand this concept and who are at least somewhat early adopters for this kind of product. Otherwise, I think it's too weird. You got to imagine like a teenage, you know, think of like a 17-year-old teenage girl sitting down with us to look at this product. She chooses her avatar and she's like, oh, this is really fun. She's like customizing the avatar, deciding how she's going to look. She gets into that. She's like, that's really cool. Then we say, all right, it's time to download the instant messaging add-on. And she'd be like, what's that? We're like, well, it's this thing. It interoperates with the instant messaging client. And she's looking at us like, I've never heard of that. My friends have never heard of that. Why do you want me to do that? I mean, it requires a lot of explanation. Instant messaging add-on is not a category that exists in her mind. But since she's in the room with us, we could talk her into doing it. So she downloads the product, have her install it on the computer, and then we're like, okay, it's time to check it out. You know, invite one of your friends to chat. And she's like, no way. We're like, why not? She's like, well, I don't know if this thing is cool yet. You want me to risk inviting one of my friends to a thing I don't think is cool? What are they going to think of me? If it sucks, they're going to think I suck, right? And we're like, no, but it's going to be so fun once you finally, you know, get the person in there. It's a social product. And just the look of dubiousness, I mean, you can just see this is a deal breaker. And, of course, the first time you have that experience, you can be like, all right, it's just that person. Let them out, you know. Send them away. Get me a new one. So then the second customer comes in, same thing. Third customer comes in, same thing. You start to see these patterns. You're like, okay, no matter how stubborn you are, there's obviously something wrong here. And the customers kept saying to us stuff like, well, I want to use it by myself. So I want to try it out first to see if it's really cool before I invite a friend in. We were from the video game industry, so we understood what that meant. That meant single player mode, right? So we built a single player mode, and we'd bring the customer in, they customize their avatar, download the product, they go into this single player mode, and we say, look, you can play with your avatar and see the cool moves they can do and dress up. And so we do that, and then...
Oh, I lost you. I'm going to call you right... Can you hear me?
Oh, what's that?
Sorry. You were saying single player mode, and then I lost you. We've got pretty bad technology, but...
Yes.
...where you decided that you were going to do single player mode.
Oh, yeah. So with single player mode, what that meant was after the customer would come into our office and customize their avatar, which, remember, they really liked that part, then they would download, and we would let them decorate their avatar and kind of show them the cool moves they could do and decorate their room, all their stuff by themselves. So we have them do that, and then we say, okay, you did it by yourself. Now it's time to invite one of your friends. And you can see what's coming, right? They're like, no way. We're like, why not? They're like, this isn't cool. And you can see the frustration. We're like, well, we told you it wasn't going to be cool. And that was the whole point of, you know, what is a single player? And they just look at us like, listen, old man, you don't understand. What is the deal with this crazy, you know, inviting people before I know it's cool? Like, it's a total deal breaker. And so out of complete desperation, we were like, okay, fine. We'll introduce a simple, we called it Chat Now. It was a matching thing where you could push a button and you would be randomly matched with somebody else from around the world. The only thing you have in common is you both push that button at the same time. And we did that, and all of a sudden people were like, oh, this is fun. And then here's what happened. So we bring them in, they do the Chat Now. Maybe they'd meet somebody new who they actually thought was kind of cool. They'd be like, hey, that guy was neat. I want to add him to my buddy list. Where's my buddy list? And we're like, oh, no, you don't want your own buddy list. You want to use your regular AOL buddy list because that's, you know, interoperability and network effects, all this nonsense. And the customer's looking at us like, well, that doesn't make sense. What do you want me to do exactly? And we said, well, just give the stranger you just met your AIM screen name so you can put them on your buddy list. You can see the eyes go wide. They're like, are you kidding me? A stranger on my AIM buddy list? And we'd be like, but otherwise you'd have to download a whole new instant messaging client and then you'd have to have your separate buddy list. And they're looking at us like, do you have any idea how many instant messaging clients I already run? And we'd be like, no, what, like two or three? And Tina's like, duh, I run 8, right? Like they're already running like 50 clients. I had no idea how many instant messaging clients there were in the world. And we had this like preconception that, oh, it's a challenge to learn new software and it's tricky to, move your friends over to the new buddy list, and all this other nonsense sitting in our heads that just for our customers looked at us like we're crazy. I mean, we'd be drawing them at the whiteboard the strategy diagram for why this was brilliant, and they'd just be laughing at us. You'd be like, "What are you talking about?" And plus, never mind the fact that they're on MySpace. We're like, "What's MySpace?" Right? Like we're in a mental model of how people use software and what it was about that was years out of date. And so eventually, painfully, after tons of meetings like that, it started to dawn on us that the IAM add-on concept's not working anymore. And you're looking at the guy who wrote the code to do the IAM interoperability. I don't know how many tens of thousands of lines of code that was. And I was at the time, I was a real advocate for agile software development. So we had done that. I'd written that code with unit tests, and I'd really tried hard to keep it well factored and the documentation and kind of all the stuff you're supposed to do for iterative product development. And it was a real revelation to me after my co-founders finally convinced me, I was very slow on the uptake, believe me, that this whole, all the energy I'd put into that software, despite all the best practices we had used to build it, was still waste. It was still a waste of time to have built it, and we had to throw all that code away. And I'm actually, it was very painful. I was not a happy camper for some time there. Luckily, my co-founders were able to convince me against my better judgment to do it. But it became a real touchstone for me, a real lesson in the power of really getting serious about what constitutes progress in a startup. What is waste and what's adding value? And to me, the biggest source of waste in any startup is building something that nobody wants.
Eric Stevens, who I interviewed here, does nothing but the kind of user experience development that you do. And he will sit and watch customer after customer use the websites that he's helping to improve, and he'll see what the problem is, and he'll go and he'll tell it to the investors who are funding the business. He'll tell it to the CEO, and they still will fight him. And what he's done is he will shoot videotape of the people getting frustrated, and that's what he shows. And he says that's what finally convinces people. It's not until you actually see the customer getting frustrated that you recognize that you're on the wrong track. All right, I've got a couple of things here that you said that I want to dig deeper into. The first is, you talked about all the different things that you built. Single player mode was just one of them, and that's a pretty intense piece of code there. I'm imagining somebody listening to this saying, that's great for Eric. He probably had a ton of funding, a ton of people working in the company. If you're a small startup, a lean startup, you can't afford to try all these things. You have to say, I built this, let's find a way to get customers to buy it. So does it take a lot of money to do this?
No. And listen, when I say we built this, I mean, I literally mean me and my co-founders with our own bare hands. I mean, we were not a very well-financed company at this time. In fact, the traction we were able to get at this micro scale is what eventually enabled us to raise significant venture money and hire a much bigger team. But in the time that we're talking about so far, this is five guys in a garage. I mean, that's it. And I actually think I've heard that concern before from bootstrapped companies that like, oh, we can't afford to do that. But to me, that's crazy. I think you can't afford not to do it. That is, I'm not advocating that companies take on more work. I actually think the lean approach to building a company in the end results in less work because you eliminate the biggest source of waste, which is building stuff that nobody wants, and you discover a lot sooner if you're on the wrong track. So, my claim is not that people, need to take longer to launch their product and take longer before they get customers trying to buy it. I want them to try to get customers to pay for their product as soon as humanly possible, as soon as they've achieved what we call the minimum viable product. And most people have a way overinflated idea of what minimum really means.
Well,
So
before
if
we
you
get
can
into,
really build that,
I'm sorry, I want to ask about that. Money. You keep talking about the importance of data. Money seems like a very valuable piece of data, whether people are buying from you or
Oh,
not.
yeah.
Is how important is it for startups to charge so that they could get that data?
Well, it there's two levels to the answer. The level one answer is absolutely, it's very important. I think the most powerful piece of data you can collect in a startup is to understand whether people are willing to, bust out their credit card and hand over their hard-earned money for your early product. Just the easiest way to tell if you're dealing with early adopters who truly believe who you're truly solving a problem for. I mean, those customers, those visionary customers, in a lot of cases are more visionary even than the founders of the company themselves. And so they're really buying on the promise of what they think you can build in the end, not necessarily what you've already built. So that's a very powerful validation that you're really on the right track. The second level answer, the kind of the more complicated and unfortunately more true answer, is there are some situations where there are other metrics you want to use for evaluating traction. So in the very special case, like you're in a kind of LinkedIn or Facebook type, a true network effects type business, what you want to see much more so than the revenue you make for customers, you want to understand the kind of retention of customers over time. If you see kind of customer retention increasing on a cohort basis over time rather than decreasing like it normally does, that's kind of the special case where you see customers who are trying to churn out of a product, but they can't. They're literally getting sucked back in. They can't leave, right? They're stuck there. There are other kind of very special situations like that. And of course, the ultimate special situation, like you've invented a cure for cancer. And we don't really have to ask ourselves, like, are customers going to want that if you are succeeding? So, I mean, so there are these special cases. The reason I never mentioned that first is that entrepreneurs are very skilled at convincing themselves that they're in the special case and the normal rules don't apply to them. And so I always recommend just try the revenue path first and kind of check out if you're in that, if you're in kind of the world where that can give you the information you want. Because if you are in that world, it's really important to know. And like I said, I mean, I was even in the category of companies that thought we were in a network effects business when we weren't. And so, you know, you've got to be really cautious about that before you conclude that you don't need to worry about revenue.
Eric, this is great. Every time I write a note, you start talking about it. Like you were talking about network effect. That's my next question here. And yeah, I was going to say that I thought that InView wasn't a network effect business. That what do I care what my avatar looks like unless my friends are there? And the more friends I have, the more likely I am to care about my existence in this world. Why isn't that a network effect business?
It's not because, and this is going to sound simple, but InView is a product for meeting new friends, not for hanging out with the friends you already have, which you wouldn't think is a very big difference in terms of the value proposition of our product. But in my experience, it's actually one of the most decisive choices that these kind of products have to make early on that bifurcates their whole business strategy into very different worlds. So one way to think about it is a lot of these online socializing products help people deal with their social capital. That is the number of people in their network and the kind of set of people they can use to rely on, to kind of reach out to if they need help, or just to talk to if they're looking for somebody to listen to them. And so in the social sciences, there's a whole field of study about social capital. And it's a real thing. It matters. People's happiness is correlated with how much social capital they have. My way of thinking is that products like Facebook, LinkedIn, even MySpace to some extent, traditional instant messaging, are places you can take your existing social capital and invest it for better returns. So you can kind of meet friends of friends, you can get closer with the friends you do have, you can kind of talk to all your friends at once, which are all really useful new tools. But what if you don't have that much social capital to begin with? Right? Then you're not really looking for an investment account, you're looking for ways to build new social capital that is brand new out of scratch. And that's especially true if the kind of social capital you have is not the kind you want. So of course there's different flavors. If you're the only goth in a suburban high school, you may actually know people, lots of people at that school, but they don't really get you. And so that's not the capital you want to invest. What you want to do is go find other like-minded people online where you can, you know, you can meet them and you can have, hang out with them in a kind of a safe space where you can all be goth together. The term network effects is complicated there because, of course, the more goths that are on the network, the more valuable it will be to a new goth that signs up. But it's much less of a pronounced effect than it is with something like Facebook, where the value is really proportional to the number of your actual friends that are on there. And you have a strong incentive to bring your friends onto the platform in order to connect with them. In products like InView, my belief is that customers don't feel like it's their obligation to bring new people onto the platform. They think of that as our obligation. Like that is, it's like a dating site. You don't bring your friends to the dating site. You go to the dating site because you think already the people you want to meet are already going to be there. And so it's really that the network effect is driven by the number of people you might want to meet rather than the number of your friends who are already on there who you could connect with at any time. And so it's a much stronger effect in something like Facebook or instant messaging than it is for products like InView. That's my belief anyway.
You mentioned earlier the minimum viable product, and there are places where people can read more about it from you,
yeah.
Specifically Venture Hacks. But can you talk a little bit more about it here? Just explain what it is, and you say that most entrepreneurs think that the minimum is way bigger than it should be. So maybe we can help them understand what the minimum viable product should look like.
Sure. I'll mention an exercise I just did on my blog that I always feel like I have to practice what I preach. So I really try to force myself to do these things even when they're a little bit uncomfortable. In fact, kind of the essence of customer development is taking you out of your comfort zone. That's the whole point, to get you it's much more comfortable to deal in fantasy than in reality. Reality is unfortunately very uncompromising. So I did I had this idea to do a workshop. We're going to do a lean startup workshop. The idea is to do an all-day in-person event in San Francisco, and then potentially in other cities, where we'd actually get like-minded entrepreneurs together and really work on being able to talk about these concepts in depth and really try to build an action plan for, okay, how could any given entrepreneur bring this back to their company and make it more lean, right? So, one of the ideas that as a blogger, you kind of have these ideas periodically. So I thought, all right, what's the minimum viable product for a lean startup workshop? And I started working on the curriculum, and I started working on finding a venue, and I was like, wait a minute, how is anybody going to find out what the curriculum is or what venue it is? The first thing I need to figure out is, does anybody actually want to do this workshop? So I posted on the blog. I said, I announced May 29th there will be this workshop, and I asked people who are interested to take a survey. So I figured, it'd be useful to get that information to find out, okay, well, what's people's level of interest just in the concept of a workshop? It's a 5-page survey. You go through it, ask you a few questions about how much you'd like to pay, and we can talk about, minimum viable product is a lot about pricing and really understanding what are the pain points they're trying to solve for people. The last page of the survey, it said, actually, there is going to be this workshop. It's going to cost this much. It's going to happen on this date. Here's approximately what's going to happen. And if you'd like, you could put down a deposit to reserve your spot in the workshop in advance. I think the deposit was $100, and I don't remember exactly. The workshop was going to be expensive. And I thought, I picked a price point where I figured, well, probably nobody would be willing to pay that much for an unspecified kind of vague workshop. But let's find out. Let's actually find out whether there are today early adopters who are bought into the concept sufficiently that they really want to be there and they really want to be part of that first wave of evangelists for this idea. I was totally blown away by the number of responses that we got to that. I mean, I predicted at the most, 3 or 4 people maybe would be like willing to, as a favor to me, maybe check it out. But I'm now struggling to find a venue where we can accommodate all the people that wanted to come to the workshop. So, I mean, hey, go me, that's great. That's really exciting. But I was really nervous about it. I mean, and that's like the way you have a minimum viable product is you are very uncomfortable putting your name on it and like putting it out there and really having the courage to say, okay, even though I haven't set the curriculum, even though I don't know where the venue is going to be, even though, I'm only vaguely aware of the fact that I think people want to do this thing. Nonetheless, I have the chutzpah to say, no, it's going to happen on this date. It costs this much. Who wants to come? And I would have viewed it equally successful as an experiment if nobody had signed up than as what happened where a ton of people signed up. And, either way, I would have learned a lot about, okay, what is it that customers want or don't want? And then not only that, I would have identified, I had a couple hundred people take the survey who gave me their phone numbers and said, yeah, I'd be happy to talk to you if you have questions. So I can call those people up and say, hi, can I have 20 minutes of your time? Why did you or did you not want to pay for this thing? That is, and really start to understand, what is the value that people think they would get in a workshop? And is a workshop even a good venue for talking about the lean startup? I mean, so far it looks pretty good, but we'll see.
Why a survey before the order form? Wouldn't it have been more like the actual product if you had an order form on the page? And if you said, I'm going to be doing this event, I'll tell you the date later on, but this is what it's going to cover, this is how much it is, do you want to buy it? And then ask them why, and then ask the survey.
Yeah, that totally would have been better. I didn't have the courage to do that. I had to hide. I say how important it is to go out on a limb and kind of put yourself out there, and there was a limit to what I could talk myself into. It felt like so outrageous. And actually, that's the point I want to make is it doesn't really matter the form in which you do it. It's like minimum viable product is a matter of judgment, and there's no right answer, and it's not a one-time thing. That is, if nobody has signed up for that survey, like imagine nobody had taken the survey or even like read the blog post, then I would have been like, okay, I need to go experiment at that level. Or let's say everyone had taken the survey but nobody paid, then that would tell me, okay, the next iteration of this, I need to go. And look, people have put down a deposit to reserve their spot, but you know, now I actually have to go collect the money from them, get them to come to the world. I mean, there's a lot of stuff still to happen. These minimum viable product exercises help you identify where you need to do further experimentation. They're not designed to kind of be the one-time authoritative, okay, we did a survey, we're done, we know what customers want. That's not the idea. The idea is a dynamic, ever-changing, ever-iterating process of gaining customer insight.
Let's suppose you did it the other way. Let's suppose instead of a survey, you put up an order form. I'm going to be doing this event at this time in Seattle, for example. You got it up on your site. You see that only three people want to come. No one else is saying yes. How do you find out if it's because no one's as crazy about Eric, or because they could get your stuff for free on your blog, or because they know that Mixergy is going to show an interview with them? They're not giving you their information.
I've ruined the market for the workshop right here.
You're giving it away for free here.
That's right. Well, and you know, those are the great questions. And actually, the first thing before you even tackle any of that, the most important thing is you got to not be afraid of the false negative. That is, if you're one thing that, like, I had this problem when I first started getting customer feedback. My initial reaction was just to do whatever customers said, and I would just panic at the first sign that customers didn't like what I was doing. And so it was just like I put my toe in the water, I get burned, and I would run the other way. And that's actually part of the same mental complex that gets people to not want to get feedback in the first place because it's so scary. So the first thing I do is take your fear level down. Say it's okay to get negative feedback. Okay to have customers say, you are so crazy doing this. Like, I was expecting people would comment on my blog post, like, who the hell do you think you are? Right? You don't get to do this kind of thing. You know, you're not important enough to, you know, have people come to a workshop. Like, I was fully ready for that, and I had the apology practically written of what I was gonna post as the follow-up to say, I'm so sorry, I've overstepped my I didn't mean to offend, right? You gotta be willing to apologize. But then you gotta say, all right, well then let's iterate. So once you accept the false negatives, that doesn't mean it's a bad idea. It might just mean that you messaged it wrong, or that you messaged to the wrong customers, or maybe just nobody can come to Seattle. That's why, you know, you do things like surveys to kind of get a feeling for, like, I noticed that the number of people in the survey who said they would be willing to pay $2,000 to come to the workshop was different from the number of people who actually would be willing to pay that to come to the workshop. It's much higher, right? People don't always know what it is that they want. But once you know what questions to ask, then you can call them up. I mean, you just say, hi, you engaged with this thing, you're obviously interested, what do you think the problem is? And like, here, you know, get some feedback from a bunch of people, and then run another experiment. So, you know, I'm always convinced when it's something that I'm doing wrong, I'm always like, well, it's the messaging, not the product, right? It's never the product. It's always, well, we didn't, you know, say the right words in the special form, so do it again. Right? Do another version with the better messaging. And after 3, 4, 5, 6 experiments with the messaging, you're still not getting any signups. You know, think about, that's again analogous to me with my instant messaging add-on and the 6th, 7th customer who's just like, no way, it's a deal breaker. Reality will start to eventually permeate your brain and say, wait a minute, something just is not right. This fundamentally isn't the right product. Let's try a different variation.
Let's see.
And the great thing about minimum viable product is you get to do all that experimentation before you've built anything. I mean, I often recommend to startups, just do an AdWords campaign and a landing page for the product you hope to be able to build. In fact, a lot of times, don't even say what the product is. Just offer people the benefits that you think they would really want and offer them by magic. Because if you can't sell magic, you certainly won't be able to sell technology that doesn't work quite as well, right? You know, just get out there and find out, is there anybody on earth who's interested in the benefit that I'm trying to create?
I used to do this in direct marketing. I had an online direct marketing company, and I'd come up with an idea for a book. It was never a book. It was a guide, because that way I could keep it smaller. And I'd say, I want to do a guide on how to trade stocks, but I don't know if anyone's going to buy it. Let's just create an ad, and I know that I have 3 to 4 weeks to ship out the guide, so I'll run it for a week. I'll see if enough people want to buy from me, and if they do, I'll create it. If not, I'll give them back their money.
Yeah.
It seems like a lot of these ideas that you're talking about come from direct marketing. Is that where they come from, or does there happen to be a relationship there?
Well, I think that, you know, people who are in the same situation will reinvent the same kind of solutions. I mean, I've never done direct marketing for a living, but I've heard that story and for a lot of these techniques elsewhere. I think it's more like there are only so many jobs in kind of the legacy industries that actually depend on building something new for customers and are judged strictly on results. So you can't, there's no, like in direct marketing, there's no excuses for failure. So it's like I talked about the need to have that motivation to really get in touch with the truth. If you don't have the motivation, you can have all the good process in the world you want. It's not going to help you. And it's just too easy to convince yourself that basically anything is, you know, potentially true. So so I do think, but I also, I want to make sure that I emphasize, because this is a common source of confusion, I'm not really advocating this as a marketing discipline. That, like, you know, this is kind of like, sometimes engineers will be like, listen, marketing is code for lying. Okay, that's basically what it is. And the sleazy people go into marketing and they trick people into doing it. Like, that's not the idea here. And so it's not just about kind of trying whatever comes to mind. And, you know, there's that famous story about Google split testing 20 different colors of blue, you know, because they couldn't make a decision. Like, to me, and even a lot of these, like, smoke test experiments, they're only worth doing if they teach you something really big about what customers do or don't want. So I'm a big advocate for this metrics-based development and split testing and smoke testing and all these specific tactics, but only if they're in service of a larger vision that actually matters. So it's important to start with, like, an actual idea for a company that, that would matter, that you actually think, okay, we're doing something that's going to make the world a better place, that actually solves a legitimately difficult problem for people. It makes their lives better. If you really believe that, then that's the faith that will carry you through all these setbacks. As you start to get information about, all right, if that's what we want to do, what is required? Because, like, it's not good enough to just say, hey, I have a good idea and world accommodate me. Doesn't work that way.
And still, this is what happened to television. People on television said, we are the actors. We're going to come up with the best shows that will educate people and raise them up. And then they started listening to the audience, and then they started getting more metrics on the audience. And the more metrics they had, the more they went towards trash television that's now practically worthless or doesn't have any intellectual value in it. So isn't that what we're about to teach people to do here in technology? To dumb down their ideas to a point where they could get as big an audience as possible, and we now no longer have our vision of changing the world.
No, I think that's a terrible mistake. I think that you're every, like, startups, you know, big companies can afford to do that, but startups generally blow up if that's what they do. The concept, I use the word synthesis to say we're trying to match our vision with reality and find the synthesis between what we want and what's possible that kind of makes sense. And if you look at the really great companies, the paths that they, these kind of these winding paths they took, where they kind of started off over here and be like, oh, we'll do cyber cash for PDAs. And then they're like, well, that's not quite right. Customers, they want this online payments with email. But then our vision is to create a one world currency. So we got to make sure we, you know, set it up in this way. I mean, that's what it looks like. You're kind of going back and forth between what you want to do and then the data about what's possible. And there may not be a fit. I know I counsel people sometimes, fail fast. So what that means is, if you conclusively determine that your idea is basically has no possibility of working, it's just a bad idea, just for God's sakes, shut it down and start something else. You know, that's, try to keep a kind of a light attachment to the specifics of your idea. Because usually what happens is, even if your idea is really bad, as most initial ideas are, there's usually a kernel of truth inside. And so another way to look at it is these sources of data, what customers want, our goal here is to chip away the cruft from that kernel of truth. To find out, no, the really powerful aspect of the product is it helps people connect with their friends better. It helps people, you know, not be late to an important appointment. It helps people save money. It helps people, you know, express themselves. Like, there's some kind of core in there that if you can access, then you can say, all right, well, given that's what we want to do, and now that we've validated that's what customers want, what's a physical manifestation of that in the world that customers could actually pay us money for? That's really the challenging part.
Does this only work in technology and only in our world within technology, or or can we do this anywhere? Can we do it with physical stores out in the real world? Can we do it with clean energy technology?
I don't want to claim that it can be used for anything, because, you know, that's one of those statements that gets you in trouble. But I have seen, certainly in my work with companies and the speeches that I've been giving recently, people have been coming up to me to tell me stories of these principles in wide application in domains I never would have considered. I mean, in packaged goods and in clean tech and in all kinds of places. It comes into play any place where there's what we call market risk. That's where you're doing something and the success of it hinges on customer adoption of some kind. That is, we want customers to change their behavior in some way. And that can be true because we want people to use our social service agency in the nonprofit world to access certain services. Well, my question would be, how do you know that they have any interest in accessing those services? And if they do have interest, how are you going to get them the information and get them in the door? It can be true in government situations where, you know, a lot of innovative government programs are about trying to figure out how can we get this desirable result from our population. And of course, it's true in any business situation where we want customers ultimately to make a purchase. I mean, a lot of the ideas that I use for the Lean Startup come out of Lean Manufacturing, which was pioneered by Toyota in the 50s to build cars. So I feel like if it can be used to build cars, what's your excuse that your product is harder? I mean, no way. There's very few products in this world that are harder than the automobile to produce.
Eric, why are you doing this? I see that you spoke, I think, in Vancouver recently. You're speaking with me for about an hour. You're going to be speaking at Startup to Startup, I hear, tonight. You're going to be in Austin, I hear, if you can find time to set it up. You're now going to be putting together some kind of workshop.
Yes, and a free webcast tomorrow with O'Reilly, don't forget.
And O'Reilly, yes, that's right. So why? What's your goal here? You're trying to make money selling this information? You've given it away. It's too late.
Yes, I have not pursued a profit-maximizing strategy in the short term. You know, so I've been evangelizing a number of these ideas for years. Thinking of it as a kind of a technology problem, and my background's in product development, so I used to think these were technical problems, but behind every technical problem is always human problems. And then thinking of it as an agile software development or kind of open source phenomenon, that those were the trends that mattered. And those trends are really important. But I've come to realize that there's really a higher level of understanding that I think we need as an industry. And if you look at the beliefs that we have as an industry about how we're making the world a better place, about how we're really humble in the face of failure, how we learn from our mistakes, and how we, most importantly, how we tap into the creativity of the world's smartest people for to use that energy for good. But then you look at what our behavior is. I don't think our actions live up to those ideals. I really don't. And for whatever reason, the last 6 months, 12 months, I assume because of the financial crisis, because of kind of the negative returns that people are starting to see in certain VC context, because of the kind of, I think, the intellectual bankruptcy of the old model, people are listening to these ideas in a new way. They're open to the possibility that maybe there's a better way that we should organize ourselves as an industry. And so my passion is really to figure out, you know, is this the moment when we could change what's considered best practices? We could change the status quo, build an ecosystem that is actually supportive to these ideas for when the next boom comes back, which I think is going to be soon for the tech business especially. You know, could we actually build the next wave of companies in a capital efficient, lean, iterative, and customer centric manner?
But
I think
so
that's pretty good.
Is it an altruistic goal? Because the truth is, you could take these ideas, hoard them to yourself, maybe introduce them to a handful of people, have good co-founders, build another great company, profit, build another great company, sell it, profit, and so on. And Andrew and the people who are listening to you and me don't have to know any of this stuff for you to benefit.
No, they sure don't.
In fact, you're spending a lot of your time here that you could have been spending building your company. Is it because you're trying to get deal flow? Is it because you're trying to find your next great startup to invest in, your next great partners to have? Is that why you're going out there and having these conversations? Or is it just altruistic, your need to change your part of the world so that it can change the rest of the world?
I'd be the last person to claim this is altruism of any kind. I think I stand to benefit from this change as much as everybody else in the industry. But and I thought a lot about just creating a new company and applying these principles myself, but frankly, I think it's too small. I don't think that that's going to have the kind of impact that I am hoping getting, like, really evangelizing these ideas will have. And I also don't think, you know, I'm painting a vision of what I think the future is going to look like. I don't think I can cause that vision to come into being by myself. I don't think all the good ideas have been thought already. I don't think we've worked out all the implications of these principles that we need to. And so I think I'll be the beneficiary as much as anybody else of a world in which other great thinkers and other, other mediocre thinkers too, maybe people at my level and hopefully people a lot smarter, will come together and say, there is a better way, and we'll all benefit if we can transform the industry from, you know, what I think has been a kind of value-destroying paradigm to a value-creating paradigm. You know, certainly in the software business, you think about how many products are left on this earth in the industrialized world, I'll say, that are sold that do not involve software, either in the product itself, in its creation, in its assembly, in its design. And yet, our ability to produce reliable, high-quality software as an industry is abysmal. Our track record is just not very good. So part of me feels like, how are we going to survive as a civilization if we don't learn to master these concepts, you know, in an in-depth way? Certainly, we're going to squander a lot of precious, precious resources, and I think the most precious resources, people's time, energy, and passion. But, you know, more than that, I'm not sure we're going to have such a good outcome in terms of the world that we're going to live in the future. So anyway, I don't mean to get too grandiose here at the end, but those are my aspirations to try and do
No,
some of them.
that's a great way to end it. In fact, I want to be fair with your time, so I won't go through the rest of my questions on this sheet, even though I have a bunch of great ones. People don't know, I had a handful of books here. I wanted to talk to you about how all this
Oh my
relates to
God.
my conversation with Seth Godin, about my obsession with Ted Turner. We didn't get to talk about that. We're going to have to do another interview here, but I'll end it by asking you to ask yourself a question. Is there anything that you think people who are watching this or listening to this need to know that I didn't get to ask?
You cut out while you were giving me that last question. It would have been cool, very punchy if I'd been able to hear it.
This is the minimal viable product right here, just me and you on Skype. Is there anything that I should have asked you that you think people who are listening to this need to know the answer to? Is there anything that I missed here that's important?
Well, there's a ton of detail. You know, I mean, sometimes I mean, we can talk for an hour just on like one of the lean startup principles or one of the practices like continuous deployment. I mean, that could take hours just to get into the details of how that work. I think the question I would ask everybody to think about, and I don't think this is unique to me. The question is, what could we be doing right now differently as an industry that would unlock more of our human potential? I think anyone who hears this on any given day could walk back to their office and immediately make one small change that could start to catalyze that new way of working. And so, you know, I'd be very interested to hear people's thoughts about that. If people want to come to the blog or get in touch, you know, hear people's stories of their attempts to do it. I think what matters is not so much the talking about it, but the doing it. And so how could we get started?
Wow. Well, that's a perfect place to end because I want every interview that I do here to actually lead to something. It's not just enough for me to have people have some kind of intellectual awakening. They have to be able to go out there and act. And so
Amen.
I appreciate your call to action there.
Yeah, well, listen, when you actually have some reader stories about what happened as a result, we'll come back and we'll talk about them.
I love it. Thank you. Thanks for doing this interview with me.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Thanks.
Take care. Thanks very much.
And there's the interview. This interview happened because Kareem Mayan has watched my past interviews and thought that I should bring Eric Reese on here, and he actually introduced me to Eric and helped put this interview together. If there's someone that you think I should bring on Mixergy, if there's someone that you think other startups need to hear from, let me know about them. Make the introduction by email if you know them, or if you don't know them, just tell me about them and I'll go out and find a way to bring them on Mixergy. Thanks for watching, and I'll see you in the comments or by email.